From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll learn how researchers are trying to improve diversity in clinical trials. Then, a Wisconsin County Board supervisor talks about how environmental work can be done on the local level.
We are the environment, and the environment is us. And so, if we have that mindset, and we understand that there is this continuum of connection, why I am so passionate about local control is because patchwork of legislation is actually what we need.
Plus, we'll hear from local birders, young and old, about their spark birds that got them into birding.
The bird I'm going to talk about is cardinals. I saw them in my backyard today, and they're so cool of the red fur and the red beautiful face.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. What's your spark bird? If you're interested in birds, it's the one that got you hooked on birding. We'll hear stories from local birders about their spark birds later in the show. But first, in medical research, clinical trials are how new treatments, drugs, or surgeries get tested. They're how researchers figure out whether treatments work and whether they're safe and effective. But nationwide, clinical trials have a diversity problem. People of color are often underrepresented. It means that what researchers learn doesn't apply to as many people as it should. That can perpetuate poor health outcomes. Researchers from the Advocate Aurora Research Institute, which serves Wisconsin and Illinois, recently checked on the health system's own clinical trials. As part of the study, the researchers sat down with Black, Hispanic, and Asian community members to hear how they think diversity in these trials can be improved. Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick is a research scientist who led the study, and Osandi Ozani-Lohr is a senior research associate who helped with the community interviews. They joined WUWM's Lena Tran to share what they learned.
So the study was funded by the Advocate Charitable Foundation. So they gave us money to sort of look at the equity in our COVID clinical trials. And so through this, we were sort of like, well, if we're going to look at just our COVID clinical trials, which there were only like half a dozen, and Advocate Aurora runs like 80 to 120 clinical trials. So our COVID clinical trials were not a very large, you know, section of our portfolio. We sort of were like, okay, if we want to look at the equity in clinical trial in our COVID clinical trials, why don't we look at the equity in all of our clinical trials? And then why don't we look at how representative this is of our health system or our clinics or the area? And so we sort of took our funding and tried to answer bigger questions with it.
Just to back up, this is going to sound maybe really obvious, but why is it important that your clinical trials are representative of the community that you're serving?
Science and clinical trials in general is a fundamental kind of subject where if our trials are not equitable or if it doesn't show enough diversity, those results get perpetuated. And it creates, you know, kind of bias, too. It creates a situation where a certain group of people are not, they don't get access to innovative healthcare, and it creates health outcomes disparity. If we have a study in that sense that's lacking diversity, it gets perpetuated. So somebody else would pick that study and, you know, make it a building block of their study. So solving that problem at its initial stage is very important.
It's not everyone is white men.
Exactly. Groundbreaking observation.
Yeah, exactly.
Not everyone is white men.
My research actually is mostly in care delivery and prenatal care. As we're seeing across this country, there's a really, really big issue with Black women in particular having, you know, maternal and their baby outcomes are just not embarrassingly poor in this country. And that's not anything that has to do with our healthcare system in general. That's just like across the board. It's so critical to have people enrolled in these studies who are going to be benefactors of the results.
Are there examples of medications or treatments that historically, like, their effectiveness was shaped by race or gender, and people realize, like, oh, it's because we just weren't assessing how well they work on all the right people?
I think heart disease is a really good example of that. I think that generally it was thought, I mean, because all clinical trials for heart disease were in white men, you know, and the way heart disease looks in women is very, very, very different than men. And the drugs and the treatments weren't as effective in women. And so finally they were like, wait a minute, maybe we should include women in clinical trials. And it turns out that it was totally different.
So you set out to do this inventory. What are the trends that you find?
So we found that the people most likely to participate in clinical trials are white women over the age of 65. We also found that people of color are not as well represented in clinical trials. And so we set out to create like this environment where we could talk to the people in the community that we serve and see what the barriers are, what's preventing them from participating in clinical trials, and what solutions that they think that we could apply and make them participate more in clinical trials.
So what kinds of things did you hear from them?
I think the most interesting thing was when we started to conduct the interviews, trust was one of the things that was just in the back of my mind, because we all have that little bias in our heads. But what we found it was trust was a byproduct of the need for more knowledge about clinical trials, more of a presence in the community. If the people that we are trying to approach about clinical trials don't understand clinical trials because they haven't been exposed enough, or they don't know us as well, it's difficult for them to participate and trust us enough to participate in clinical trials.
I think there's a lot of mistrust among communities of color when it comes to any sort of experimental medicine, right? Very, very well-founded sort of lack of trust. And I think to Asandi's point, you know, not all clinical trials look the same, right? Like some are experimental devices and drugs, and some are just, you know, an app on your phone. And so I think there's a misunderstanding that, you know, everything is this sort of, you know, take this drug that we've never tested, or try this thing in your heart that we've never done before, when a lot of clinical trials are not that. You know, the lack of knowledge about the depth and breadth and what they entail and how they are considered legitimate treatments, I think was one thing that sort of rose to the top, was not so much that people wouldn't participate and not so much that people wouldn't participate despite not trusting the healthcare system, was just that they didn't know much about them. They didn't know anything about them until they were sick. You know, they didn't know where to even find clinical trials. They didn't know how to get more information about clinical trials. You know, and that was one of the things where we were like, oh, okay, so what can we do as a healthcare system to better educate the community so they wouldn't pass up this opportunity to be part of a potentially innovative treatment?
Yeah. How did it feel as someone who's, as a health professional, as a researcher, to hear some of those things?
There is an understanding to it. You know, one participant actually said, you know, when there is a study or a clinical trial going on, they see us. They feel that presence in the community. We're there recruiting. We're there talking to them about the study. But then when that trial or that study is over, we're gone. Because then we retreat back to do our analysis and our writing. But what we've done is we've created a relationship and a connection, and then we just kind of stop. And so I can understand that. And it's really important to have a constant connection with the people that we are serving or presenting this clinical trials to. So it's not a case of, oh, we just need you for now and we don't need you anymore.
What do you think it would look like to shift that relationship?
You know, we got so many solutions from our community members and even our clinical trial staff. And one of the things that we got out of it was creating a presence, creating some kind of connection. First of all, just having to sit down with them and listening to them.
Mm-hmm. I've been a health disparities researcher for over a decade, so I'm certainly not surprised when vulnerable populations, that could look like anything. That could be people of color, that could be lower income people, that could be people who do not speak English as a primary language. I mean, anybody who's really at a disadvantage in our super highly literate healthcare system. Asandi, I think you said it super well, which is like as researchers, we take from our communities and sometimes forget to give it back. And we, you know, what are the dissemination products of research? It's manuscripts, it's, you know, peer-reviewed papers, it's, you know, presentations at medical conferences, and that is not where the community is. Right. And those are not things that the community understands. And so I think it's really on us, and we're lucky because we work in a healthcare system, so we can actually show what the results are and we can actually make changes in our healthcare system. But I think that that's you know, people's interview time and people's opinions is means a lot to them. And to just take them and not give it back to the community, I think doesn't close that loop. And we're really, really trying to close that loop.
This is really interesting because people talk about this in journalism, too. How can we not be extractive and take people's stories and say, like, bye, never see you again? Yeah. And how can it be, like, more symbiotic?
Mm-hmm. That's so funny because you're totally right. It's the exact same thing because it's like these are people's – these are who these people are. Like, what they're giving us, the vulnerability that they're allowing us to share in is something that, you know, ends up being, you know, a line in a paper when it's not.
It's their life.
Experiences in life. Yeah. And it's just we have direct – interactions with the people that we're taking, you know, this data and their experiences from. And so we take it very seriously to try to do something with it. It's not just for funding. It's to take the lessons learned and try to implement them as best as we can.
Going back to the listening sessions, I'm wondering if either of you have a memorable moment. Was there a breakthrough or something that really surprised you?
I was kind of surprised by how many people were willing to participate in clinical trials. It's a lot of interactions with the healthcare system. It's you have to drive there, you have to sit there, you have to have some sort of treatment schedule. But I don't think there was a single person that we talked to who was like, no way.
Right.
I would never do that. Mm-hmm. Like most people were like, yeah, okay. And we talked to old people, we talked to young people, we talked to almost everybody identified as a person of color. That was one of our inclusion criteria. But yeah, I was really surprised by that because even myself, I'd be like, I don't know. It seems like a lot of work. I don't know. Yeah. But really, people were pretty enthusiastic. And again, like even though people were like, I don't totally trust the healthcare system, they were still willing to participate. And I was just like, says a lot because I think there's this misconception that like people of color don't want to interact with the healthcare system, and that is not true based on the people we interviewed.
Which is like a scientist's dream, right? There's this whole pool of data, but you've just got to bridge the gap. You know, they're willing to share it.
So. I think we make, as researchers, as, you know, predominantly white people, I think we make a lot of assumptions about how people feel, you know, and it's not until we go into the community and ask these questions directly where we can really fight those assumptions. And I think a lot of people assume, like, well, if you don't trust the healthcare system, then you're not going to participate in a clinical trial. And the community was loud and clear. They're like, we are happy to participate in a clinical trial. We literally don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And that's that point with that implicit bias, you know, because we already think in our heads, oh, you know, they don't want to. And maybe that's why we don't have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Veronica, there was this op-ed where you mentioned that Advocate Aurora has been using the past year to see how some of these suggestions could be folded in. I'm wondering if there's any more specifics that you can share on what that's looked like.
Yeah, we formed three sort of steering committees. One of them is focused on the community and sort of how, to Asante's point, how we can actually meaningfully, you know, integrate into the community. And a lot of that is partnering with our community health department. The second part of it is working on our translational services, because one of the things that also came out in our data was that there was definitely disparity when it came to Black people, but there was also a lot of disparity in people who do not speak English as a primary language. So people who identified as Hispanic and actually people who identified as Asian. And then the third part of it was how we can better use our medical record system to screen people. So one of the things that we found out in the results was that it was really hard to figure out who was being approached for clinical trials. We knew who was being consented, but you have to say yes at that point to be consented. So we've now integrated something into our medical record system where we can actually really easily document who is screened to see if there's disparity in who's being approached, which is where implicit bias would totally show up. One of the things that we're trying to do is that we tend to like lump groups together. Like we tend to be like Hispanic, and like there's a very big difference between, say, Puerto Rican and Mexican, or we do Asian, and there's a very big difference between, you know, Japanese or Chinese or, you know, like Laotian, you know, and also different likelihood of speaking English as a primary language. So I would love in the future to figure out how to like differentiate these subgroups, because I think it's going to be very telling. But that said, we're working with our translational team to try to figure out how to like just better be prepared for people who might need to be consented, allowing their families to be there for support and stuff like that. And then, like I said, we're trying to integrate more meaningfully into the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Veronica and Osandi, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Thank you for having us.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran, speaking with Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick and Osandi Ozani-Lohr from Advocate Aurora Research Institute. As part of WUWM's election coverage, we're talking with voters about the issues most important to them. For Mary Doherty, that's the environment. She's a county board supervisor in northern Wisconsin. She joins WUWM's environmental reporter to talk about her work and what makes her passionate about the environment.
When I have to introduce myself or write a bio, I always say I'm a mother. We have five kids, and that role that I've had in my life for 30 years now, it'll be 30 years at the end of June, it informs everything I do. Because at its heart, how I identify being a mother is someone that cares for the people in her life, the world that she lives in, her home, the place, has morphed out into. I work with communities around the country, and primarily in the Midwest, though, to deal with the impacts of factory farms. I'm a county board supervisor because I want to be at the table where these decisions are being made, because I want to care for my community and advocate for my community. And so those are kind of the three hats I wear right now, and they are, it all, the through line is just showing up and caring for somebody or something.
So did environmental concerns or passion around environmental issues, was that part of you in those days?
In reflecting back, because I started going out and taking pictures and listening to the natural world, I didn't identify that as being an environmentalist. I identified it as someone who is developing a relationship. And it was this, I had this intense curiosity and inquisitiveness to see what was out there waiting for me when I would go out and listen. So perhaps that could be the beginning. But it wasn't, it felt really seamless, this relationship I built with the lake and the area around it. And I know that sounds completely hoogie-moogie and nuts, but it's actually true. Like, we have a boat. Before we bought our house, I lived on our boat in the summer with the kids. So from 2001 till 2007, I lived on a boat during the summer. 30-foot sailboat with four kids and 100...
Little kids.
Yeah, little kids. With a 140-pound Newfoundland dog. But I did it because it's just like this place, it just fills me up. I never identified myself as an environmentalist. I just identified myself as someone that felt very fortunate to have a relationship with this place. And I guess that probably did inform the CAFO fight.
Describe that history a little bit.
The crazy part is I learned about it on Facebook. We were on our way to a friend of ours' cabin down in Cable, and I got a Facebook message that came through and said, from a friend of mine, and she said, hey, I'm at a USDA conference in California, and I just learned there's a CAFO going in Bayfield. And I was like, what's a CAFO? I got home Monday and I was like, I guess I'm going to fight a CAFO. I didn't know how to do open records requests. I didn't know where the stuff was on the DNR website. A friend of mine sent me a link to Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, which is the group I now work for. And so I reached out to them and I said, hey, there's a CAFO coming in and I don't know how to fight it. Can you help? Then we started a group, you know, local community members started a group called Farms Not Factories. And we just started working with everything we had to fight the proposal. Mm-hmm. And eventually, Glenn Stoddard, he worked with us to do something called an operations ordinance. It does not say no to CAFOs. It just says, tell us how you're gonna operate, and then the elected officials will condition a permit based on the information provided by the applicant. The operations ordinance addresses things like biosecurity, morbidity, what do they do with the animals when they're dead, road damage. It's a really great way for our folks that own CAFOs to show that they've done their homework and they will be good neighbors. And so we passed that in 2015 at the county board level, and then the application was pulled shortly thereafter.
So you ran for county supervisor.
Yep.
What was it at that point that drove your decision to say, I'm going to run?
In 2019, I think it was, I got a call from Western Wisconsin. The person that was trying to put the CAFO up here was in their community. So I was kind of helping her very adjacently. And because it was with policy, I was like, they always say you don't want to see how the sausage is made. Like, I think I do want to see how the sausage is made. Like, I want to be in the kitchen making the sausage so I could learn how to be a better community organizer. Because there is there's the public out here and there's the elected officials here, and there's often a huge gulf between the two. You know, and we have citizens who are passionate about something, but they're given 3 minutes to share their opinions, oftentimes when, frankly, the decision has already been made. Because a lot of, I can only speak for county government, but we do a lot of our substantive work in committee. So by the time it gets to the county board level and folks are aware of it, the sausage is nearly made and getting ready to go into, you know, on the grill. So I was like, I want to learn more about this side so I can figure out how to do better on the community organizing side. And turns out I absolutely love being on county board. County board is just like, we do important work. Like we do incredible, like for instance, we're going to talk about local control, and this isn't about CAPOs, but when Roe v. Wade was overturned, my daughter called me, my 23-year-old daughter. She's crying. She's like, what just happened? And I said, God, Sadie, you in Wisconsin, you have less rights than your brothers now. And that's just, I mean, it makes me so sad. And I was like, well, what can I do? You know, like, what power do I have? So I worked with the health department and we hired a reproductive health nurse. And we have a mobile health trailer that goes around to, they go to like the testicle festival in Port Wing. They go to the dump sometimes. They're taking healthcare into the places where rural folks don't have access. If you're a young person, and this is for men and women, reproductive health is not just women. It takes two to tango, so to speak. You know, so our county now goes out and we were bringing reproductive health into places where kids and older young women and even older people, men and women, may not have access. And so that's why I'm so passionate about local control, because that solution that we came up with doesn't benefit all of Wisconsin, but it makes a legitimate difference for the people that live in this county. And that's why I love county government. Because you can start the phone call with your kid and it shows up in something that, and working with a lot of people at the county to get this done, it wasn't just me, I just was able to pose the question. So we, like I said, we have a 3/4 time reproductive health nurse now.
If you take a single environmental issue, whichever you would choose, and maybe it depends on the issue, but where do you see the highest potential of affecting improvements in protecting some element of our environment?
I wonder about the word environment, because sometimes it feels a bit confining to me.
Yeah.
We are the environment and the environment is us. And so if we have that mindset and we understand that there is this continuum of connection, why I am so passionate about local control is because patchwork of legislation is actually what we need. Quilts are patchworks. The concept of a quilt and women together patching together the things that they bring to make something that benefits all, that is what it should be. When I think of a uniform one-size-fits-all solution, I feel like that those are the solutions that suffocate people, because they weren't there to help in the creation, so it feels very downward, heavy downward pressure. I do also believe that the state and the federal government should absolutely set the floor for certain environmental issues. The scientists and the people that do the policy, they should look at something and say, you know what, this level of X, we know that anything more than that is not going to be good, so we're going to set the floor here. And we're going to allow local communities to set their ceiling with their patchworks. And because otherwise, I don't know what happens in Ashland County. There's 30 minutes away. I don't have a deep appreciation. I wouldn't be able to go in and tell those folks at the county board what they should do as it relates to EMS. So a one size fits all, or sort of a blanket statement around, this is the way we do it in Bayfield County, so you should do this in Ashland. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. We have to be very careful with who we elect for Madison and DC, and they have to be able to be expansive in their thinking enough to allow the evolution of these communities. Because there are people moving in from out of the area. Absolutely. Immigration's been happening for ever since humans started moving around. They bring their ideas, they bring their values, they bring what they know to be true. And when they step into decision-making areas, just because they're not speaking what was been done for 100 years doesn't mean that they don't have a right to speak those things. And they don't have a right to craft policy that's more reflective of the way these communities are right now.
What do you think the best mechanism for people who ask you, Mary, how can I make a difference in what I'm concerned about? Would you say focus locally?
Absolutely. I believe that we have to interact at the state level and talk and show up at our DNR meetings and ask questions and get the documents. We have to interact with our federal level, our federal senators, and tell them what we're seeing to see if we can possibly encourage them to earmark projects or send money our way or provide stories for them so they can advocate for us on the Senate floor. And if we want to find solutions that are the shortest distance between two points and often a straight line, it's at the local level. You know, the course, it's complicated because we can get different elected officials in at the town level, things can change. But my experience has been the local level and local control is absolutely crucial to not only this industrial agriculture issues we're dealing with, but every single issue that we're going to be facing down. Because the world is changing. The climate is changing. We're seeing people moving. We're seeing, you know, Florida, you can't get property insurance when you're on the coast. There's going to be migration. Folks are going to be moving. And so at the local level, I feel called to use my position on the county board to try to codify some of the values that I understand my constituents and I share, which is issues around water, issues around housing, issues around how we care for our elders, issues around the night sky. We're working on a night sky initiative. All these things are very hyper-local, but they make a real difference for the folks who are here now. And it also signals to the folks that we'll welcome into our community that these are our values. This is the ground that we're standing on. You're welcome in to stand with us as long as we all understand that this is where we're starting from, and then what values are you bringing that can support and complement? I love the iterative process of local government because it's people that you see at the grocery store. I don't see Senator Baldwin, you know, but I do see, you know, I go downtown and I see the folks that I represent, and we talk about stuff, and that access is key to good governance.
Mary Doherty is a county supervisor in Bayfield County. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz about the issues that are weighing on her in this election year. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Later in the show, we'll give you some tips if you're trying to get outdoors with your four-legged friends this summer. But first, we'll learn about spark birds and hear which birds inspired some local birders to get into the hobby. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Think back to a time in your life when you saw a bird that piqued your interest and made you want to learn more about birds. Maybe it was the bird's colorful feathers or the way it sang that resonated with you. That is your spark bird. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez asked listeners to share the moment they discovered their spark bird. We'll hear seven different birders talk about these special birds, starting with Excret.
Hi, my name is Excret Nunez, and I'm a producer for Lake Effect and the host of Chirp Chat. And my spark bird is the mourning dove. You've probably heard it and you've probably seen it, but it's this light gray dove with black specks on its feathers and has these blue eyelids. It also makes a distinct cooing sound that I especially love to hear in the evening time when I'm out for a walk. But this bird is really special to me because it reminds me of the summers I spent with my grandparents in Nevada. I would spend a lot of my summer sitting outside on my porch with my grandpa and my grandma, and this pair of doves would nest in our porch light every summer. We spent so much time just watching the mourning doves fly up and down, building their nests with pine needles or small twigs, and it was just a really special time in my life that I look back on a lot. I always enjoyed listening to my grandpa talk to me about all the different birds and animals that lived around us. So this time in my life made me feel closer to my grandparents, but also closer to nature. My grandparents have passed since then, but similarly to how some people connect cardinals to their loved ones that have passed, that's what mourning doves mean to me. So anytime I see a pair of mourning doves, it reminds me of my grandparents and how they're looking out for me and watching for me. And so caring for these birds and being interested in them got me interested in wanting to learn more about other birds and caring about them too. And so that's also why I started Chirp Chat. And it's been really nice to have a full circle moment and really become the birder I want to be and to get out there and get to know other birders too. So thank you to everyone who shared their spark bird story with me for this episode of Chirp Chat. It's really been such a treat to hear how birds are special to your life. So with that, we'll now hear a few of those stories, starting with Izora Gross, a 7-year-old from the south side of Milwaukee.
Hello, my name's Izora, and the bird I'm going to talk about is cardinals. I saw them in my backyard today, and they're so cool of the red fur and the red beautiful face. And the front of the face, they have an orange beak so you can see the mouth. In the moonlight, it's beautiful in the night. When you ever see a cardinal at your front yard or back, you might see them in morning, noon, or night. Goodbye.
My name is Rita Flores Wiskowski, and I'm from South Milwaukee. I actually have 2 spark birds, and one of them is more honest than the next. My really cool spark bird that I mostly tell people is a great horned owl, but if I want to be honest, my real spark bird is a house sparrow. As a kid, that's what I noticed. That's what I paid attention to. When we had to do a project for school, I picked the house sparrow and I did some research at the local library and found a book on them. And so that's really my spark bird. Well, the house sparrow, they're a non-native bird, and so they're not very well liked here. They're just kind of a drab little kind of brownish and grays and things, and the male can be kind of pretty in a way with his dark bib, and you know, and they're everywhere, and they're just, you know, they're loud and they're chitty, and you know, I've gone back and forth. As a kid, I loved them, and then I learned that I wasn't supposed to, so I stopped. And I'm back there to loving them because even though I understand the destruction that they can do, I also understand that there's kids like me who the only access they have to maybe birds in nature is just in their yard and the bushes that surround their homes. And so it's accessible, the house sparrows, and they're kind of fun and cute if you don't know any better. So that's why I still have an appreciation, or I have one again, of the house sparrow.
Hello, my name is Yishai Bloom. I am 17 years old and I live in Madison. I was the ABA Young Bird of the Year in 2023 last year. My spark bird is the Baltimore Oriole, Icteris galbula. The Baltimore Oriole is an amazing bird that is bright orange. It's a neotropical migrant, which means we get them in the summer and they spend the winter in Central and South America. And they're a real treat to see returning every year. My first experience with the Baltimore Oriole came when I was 7 years old. I decided to visit a bird bedding station to see what they were doing because I was super interested in birds already. And I really wanted to see how people do science on birds. So I spent the day at the station, and there were very few birds all day, except at the last minute, the only bird that we got was a beautiful, bright male Baltimore Oriole. And so the station leaders banded the bird, and they gave it to me to hold and release when they were done. And so I got to spend this beautiful moment holding this absolutely magnificent bird. That was my first time holding any animal, especially a bird. And so I let it go, and I watched it fly away. And that was a really amazing moment for me. And I think it's what really started me on the path to becoming a big birder. And now I still do bird bedding. I am a member of the Biocorp Prairie Bird Observatory, where I spend weekends over the summer banding birds, including Baltimore Orioles, and helping with banding operations. And really, it's come full circle for me. And I think that's really special and it means a lot to me. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kathy from Pewaukee. I enjoy watching the variety of birds that come to my feeder and bird bath, but the identity of one bird always had me wondering, who sings that distinct song? I would hear its song most mornings. Turns out it's an eastern wood peewee. I haven't seen it yet, but I'll keep looking.
My name is Sierra Talavero. I am from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and now I live in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And my spark bird is the white ibis. So the white ibis is this beautiful bird, almost like knee height. And it has this beautiful curved orange bill, I would say, that they use to kind of dig into the ground, especially when it's wet. But it's just almost like an odd looking bird, honestly. But usually they're white with like black tips and just almost looks like a chicken when it walks a little bit. But it's a beautiful bird. I was actually on the campus of my alma mater, Bethune-Cookman University. It's a historical black college in Daytona Beach, Florida. And I was actually walking to one of my classes in the science building. And it was actually a little bit raining that day, but they would come out and be on the fields in groups at a time and picking through the grass. And so me being from Milwaukee to this new tropical paradise of Florida, I'm like, what are those? And so I would watch them all the time. And so ultimately I just got the nerve to be like, you know what? I'm just going to look them up. And that's when I found out that they were called white ibis. So that kind of like sparked my whole inquiry about a lot of, honestly, the birds around me, because just that alone, just that kind of Google search alone helped me identify other birds around me. So because again, being from Milwaukee, a lot of the birds that are in Florida, we don't have them up here. And so it just kind of like sparked my interest of like, well, what's that? And what's that? And it was kind of a domino effect from there. And so here I am years later, a bird nerd to the core.
Excret, hello, this is Chuck. I live in the River West neighborhood. And I lead a monthly Art of Birding walk at Linden Sculpture Garden in Milwaukee. I grew up in West Michigan outside of Grand Rapids and have lived a few other places around the country where my spark bird always seemed to precede me. A woodpecker called the Northern Flicker was my first bird to come alive from the pages of an old field guide. We have 7 different kinds of woodpecker in this part of the Great Lakes. Most of them don't migrate, but the flicker heads south for winter to look for ants. Flickers really stand out when they arrive back in March and April. They have a bright red crescent on the slate gray back of their head, and the males have a heavy black mustache. Males and females both have a dense black bib on their tan chest. They have these stylish stripes on their back and large painterly spots on their front. From a distance, they might look kind of plain, except for their unique shape and large size, but they show a flashing white patch on their behind when they fly off. I remember as a teenager, the spring morning, I saw a group of them feeding on a neighbor's lawn. I thought they looked so exotic and rare, and yet their name popped right into my head from poring over illustrations in my grandpa's bird books as a kid. I remember when I was a young poet in my 20s living in Colorado, seeing a flicker manifest itself from a haiku-like Gary Snyder poem, which goes, "Through the white spot of a flicker, receding through cedar, fluttering red surveyor's tapes, through trees, the dark woods." Out west, the flickers show red under their wings and a red mustache. Here the feather shafts are yellow, though red and yellow shafted flickers are both the same species. Like with the bird books, the poem alerted me first, then came the beautiful real-life bird. I remember later in my 20s, the first spring I lived in big, windy Chicago, seeing a flicker in a wooded cemetery on Easter weekend and feeling like I might make a home there. Here in Milwaukee, they were one of my most welcome sights and sounds of the year.
We just heard from 7 different birders from across Wisconsin sharing their spark bird stories. That story was produced by Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. At WUWM.com, you can hear more of this audio collage and find last month's Chirp Chat all about Wisconsin's raptors. Coming up, we'll learn about some of the best state parks to bring your dog right here in Wisconsin. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last week, we talked about some of the best state parks in Wisconsin to visit this summer. Today, we'll talk about the parks you can bring your pet along to. Not every trail or park is right for your pup, as author Danielle St. Louis explains in her book, A Dog Lover's Guide to Hiking Wisconsin State Parks. St. Louis joins me to share what makes a park good for your dog and some of the best locations in the Milwaukee area. A lot of us like to go hiking during the summer, and many of us like to bring our dogs. When you're looking at a hiking trail, what makes something good for a dog? What is the criteria that you use?
Some of the criteria that I use when I'm looking at trails and whether they're appropriate for bringing dogs are things like the width of the trail. So it's always a nice thing to have space when you're passing other hikers, especially other hikers who also have dogs, to have room on the trail to step aside and let those people pass by you with ample space. And so if the trail is too narrow, or if there are potential hazards, if you need to like step off the trail to let other people pass, those are types of things that I like to look for and the types of things that I comment on in the guidebook. I also look at the trail materials. So what is the makeup of the things you're walking on? So is it mostly stone or sand or dirt? Because some dogs have issues with walking on different types of materials. And it's also helpful for planning your own footwear too as a human.
Sure. Now, when we're looking at specifically trails around Wisconsin, I know I've gone outside with my dog and thought, I wonder if you should be sniffing that plant that much. I wonder if you should be looking, like, what are you doing there? Is that safe? Are there things that we need to be aware of that tend to be on trails throughout Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely poison ivy in many of our parks and poison oak, and those are plants that you should watch out for and can be more upsetting to you than your dog. But you do need to watch out if your dog gets poison ivy oils on their fur, and then if you pet your dog, then it transfers to your skin. So those plants would be more upsetting topically to you than your dog. But eating certain plants can be disruptive to your dog's, you know, GI tract and can lead to intestinal upset. So eating plants along the trail is usually something you'd like to avoid. Black walnuts are especially toxic to dogs. And so I do make note in the book about trails that have more black walnut tree populations by them. And then also, you know, any types of animal, whether it's animal droppings or like owl pellets, those types of things also can be problematic for your dog. They can contain bacteria and things that aren't going to be good for your dog and also cause GI upset. So those are the types of things that you want to look out for and try and ensure that your dog doesn't eat while you're walking along the trails.
I think anyone who's familiar with a black walnut tree will know about those big green pods that it lets off. And I could imagine a dog looking at it and thinking, oh, this is a tennis ball. This is something to play with.
Yeah, right. And so ideally you want to avoid using those black walnuts as tennis balls.
So looking at these hiking trails themselves, when we're looking around the Milwaukee area, what are some of the best trails to bring your dog?
So I specifically paid attention to state parks. So there may be additional state recreation areas in the Milwaukee area, but the three state parks that are closest to the Milwaukee area are Lakeshore State Park, which is actually downtown right by the Summerfest grounds, Kohler Andre State Park, and then Harrington Beach State Park. And so those Harrington Beach and Kohler Andre State Parks are north of Milwaukee along the shoreline there with beautiful dunes and dog beaches. So those are excellent options if you want to head to the beach on a nice summer day and take your dog with you. Lakeshore State Park in Milwaukee is a nice option for just a quick day hike, just to see the lake and the downtown skyline with your dog. It's also a park that doesn't require a park pass or permit, so you can visit for free any day of the year.
Very nice. Now, as we're looking throughout kind of the Milwaukee area and what we might consider day trips from Milwaukee, what are some of your favorite hiking trails?
For a day trip from Milwaukee, you can do Kohler Andre and Harrington Beach both as day trips. And of those two parks, Kohler Andre has more restrictive dog areas. So there's portions of the park where you're not allowed to take your dog. Harrington Beach has fewer dog restrictions, but they both have really nice trails. So Kohler Andre has got a nice area that's specifically meant for dogs and dog hiking, and it's through some really beautiful pine stands. So that's a favorite. And then Harrington Beach around the Quarry Lake is a beautiful little short mile hike that just takes you around the quarry that's filled in with water. It's a very crystal blue kind of little lake and a nice experience for walking with your dog. So those are both two options in the day trip from Milwaukee category that are really pleasant options.
Now, you mentioned restrictions. Some of these parks do have restrictions, and there are a variety of reasons why you might. What are some of the reasons that we should really adhere to the restrictions that are in place in especially state parks that might be areas for other animals?
So the restrictions regarding dogs in our state parks are generally the main rule of thumb, or the general restriction, is that your dog needs to be on a leash at all times when you're in a state park. And that is a rule for many reasons. It's a great way to keep your dog from disturbing any animals that are in the area. I know there are a lot of populations of animals that we're trying to, you know, be good stewards of those in their environments. And so keeping our dogs away from those animals and from disturbing them, so keeping them on leash so that they don't disturb them. And also so they're not causing additional erosion in areas that we're also trying to reestablish or maintain. So for example, the dunes environments at Kohler Andre State Park, it's a very sensitive environment. And so there are restrictions about taking your dog on certain parts of the boardwalk because of the potential impact of your dog being on the dune. So keeping your dog on leash is a primary restriction, but for great reasons in terms of being good stewards of and respecting the environment around us, and also respecting our fellow park visitors. As dog lovers, we tend to assume all people love dogs, but that actually isn't the case. And so it's just the best way to be respectful visitors is to keep your dog on leash and not in other people's space so that they can also enjoy the park in their own way.
For sure. Now, looking at all of Wisconsin, there are going to be a lot of people who are traveling to different parts of the state, whether they're going home or whether they're on vacation. Where are some good places to hike throughout the state? Some of your favorites.
Sure. There are so many beautiful places in Wisconsin, which is something I discovered through researching and writing the book. Some of my favorites. So in the Door County area, there are parks that are super popular. So Peninsula State Park is a very popular park and it is beautiful, but I like to visit parks that are a little less crowded. And so my recommendation for the Door County area is Pottawatomie State Park, which has a lot of the same features as Peninsula, or Newport State Park, which is also beautiful along the great beaches for your dogs as well at Newport. In the Madison area, Devil's Lake, again, is a really popular park. It's beautiful, but it's so popular that I tend to go to Mirror Lake State Park instead, which is just a little bit further away and is also very beautiful. Again, some of the same features as Devil's Lake, but just typically fewer people. So Mirror Lake is beautiful. Also on the western side of the state, southwestern Wyalusing State Park and Nelson Dewey are some of my favorites. Very beautiful. In northwestern, there's Interstate State Park, which is great. And even further up is Willow River, which is beautiful right outside of Hudson, some amazing waterfalls. So there's a lot of amazing natural features in our state that are the jewels of our state parks.
A lot of great places to check out. And if you check out the book, you will find a lot more information about each of these spaces and how you can interact with them with your dogs. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Danielle St. Louis is the author of A Dog Lover's Guide to Hiking Wisconsin State Parks. We spoke in 2022. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. And you can tune in again tomorrow at noon for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.